Hello, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 5, Optics. So we actually got snowed out yesterday and we were unable to have a normal lecture, so we are taping it, putting it on the internet for you to watch so we can keep up with our syllabus. So just a quick review of some of the material from last week. We talked about exposure, and remember the whole point of exposure is that a camera will adjust the settings when you're using one of these typical metering modes in order to keep a photograph or an image properly exposed. It's just like when you are inside a dark room and you walk outside, your eyes have to adjust so that you can actually see what is outside. Just in the similar situation, your camera has to also adjust its settings so that it can also see the amount of light that is made available to it. Remember that a typical exposure will be made so that everything looks this sort of middle gray. So maybe the photo itself won't appear to be gray, but there's a heuristic, depending on the type of metering mode that we use, that determines what should be this sort of middle, this average gray, compared to what should be black in the frame, or what should be white in the frame. And I said last week, when I was giving an example, when I stood very close to the projector screen, typically, especially when you're in the room, you can see both me and the screen, but that's too much variation, it's too much contrast for a typical camera to be able to see. So normally, something will happen. If you have most of the screen in the image, for example, and you try to take a picture, most likely the camera will try to expose the scene for the level of brightness that this projector is emitting, which is quite a bit brighter than the amount of light that is on me. And I said, I predicted that if you were to take a photo like that, then you would usually see this projector okay, but I would appear to be somewhat dark. And so while I was trying to convince everyone of that, a student in the front row actually did that for us. Larry Woods took this photo, and as you can see, and it's on the slides that you can find on the course website as well, exactly what I had mentioned would happen did. And you can see that the projector screen you can see very well in this photo. You can see the word metering as well as this sort of 3D projection from this metering mode that I was referring to. You can also tell that I am quite dark, and the reason for that is that the camera adjusted the exposure values when it was taking this photo to expose this very bright portion to be that sort of middle gray. And indeed, I took a color calculator and determined that the brightness or the luminance of this section here is actually very, very close to a middle gray. And so the result of that, since this is much brighter than everything else in the scene, is that everything else is actually quite, quite dark. And so we mentioned that there is a way that you can overcome this, especially if you want to make sure that I am properly exposed, and that would be using exposure compensation. So if we were to increase the exposure compensation, give it perhaps a stop or more of positive exposure compensation, the entire scene would be slightly brighter, or would be at one stop or 1.5 stops brighter, depending on how much exposure compensation you dial in. In that case, this screen would become a lot brighter, so it wouldn't appear to be this sort of grayish blue that you see here. It would become more white, but also the shadow areas of the scene would become brighter as well. So this is a typical scene where you can expect to need to dial in a couple of stops, or maybe just one stop of exposure compensation, in order to properly expose everything in it. And so, of course, we talked about some of the modes that are associated with a camera as well, such as just the typical very easy green frame mode where everything is done automatically for you. You have the P, a program mode, shutter priority, aperture priority, a manual mode, a bulb mode, and I forgot what the C was. I don't think I even knew what the C was in this case, but you have a variety of modes available to you that a camera can help you, or you can help a camera determine what the proper exposure is. Typically, with most of these modes, a camera will figure out one or more of those three exposure values, so shutter speed, ISO, or F number, and you will determine the rest. So if you're using one of the very easy modes, such as this green frame, for example, it'll typically figure out all three of those exposure values for you. Using shutter speed priority, though, for example, you can set the shutter speed you want to use. The camera will pick the F number that you want to use. Typically, you will also pick the ISO, because especially from, it carries over from the film days where you typically would put in one roll of film that had a fixed set ISO and you were stuck with that for the duration of that roll. And that sort of same idea has stuck with us. And typically people don't change the ISO as frequently as they can or perhaps even should. And so typically people will set the ISO first and then use one of these modes, such as shutter speed priority or aperture priority, and set the appropriate value and then let the camera decide on the other value as appropriate. And of course, even with those, because the camera is still making a determination about at least one of the factors, using exposure compensation still makes sense, because you can tell the camera that what it thinks should be middle gray perhaps shouldn't be. Perhaps it should be a little bit brighter or a little bit darker. And of course, another example that we were mentioning was snow, especially relevant to what happened to us yesterday when we were snowed out. If you went outside and took some photos in the snow without any exposure compensation, you probably noticed that the photos turned out very, very gray. And it's for this exact same reason where the camera tries to make the scene itself as a whole, especially for these metering modes that use the entire image, excuse me, when determining exposure, it makes the whole scene very, very gray, so you have to increase the exposure compensation. Okay, so that was just a quick review. Do let us know if you have any questions about it. But the real meat of this lecture is all about optics. And optics are, we're referring specifically to the lenses that you use on your camera. And it really doesn't matter what kind of camera you are using. They all require lenses to focus the light onto the sensor or the film so that you can capture a frame. And this is actually an icon from Apple's software called Aperture, which is somewhat appropriately named. But you'll notice that on this icon, they actually have some text here. It says 50mm 1:1.4. And yes, it's upside down, and I apologize for that, but most lenses actually have this same designation, and we'll talk about what this means in just a little bit. But what's interesting about optics is that unlike the electrical components that we find in digital cameras, they just don't change very much. Optical technology has sort of stagnated. Stagnated perhaps isn't the right word, but it doesn't evolve, or it doesn't go through as many revolutionary or evolutionary steps as digital media does, so as the camera itself or as computers. So, for example, cameras, or computers more specifically, or more generally rather, double in speed every 18 to 24 months. And that's a very, very fast pace for this sort of technology to evolve. Lenses, however, do not do that necessarily. And sometimes they're very, very expensive. So you can make the argument that a much more worthwhile investment for your digital photography hobby is to purchase good lenses, because they aren't going to go obsolete as quickly as your camera body. So sure, you could spend thousands of dollars on a very, very good digital SLR camera, but it doesn't mean very much if you can't also buy very good lenses to go with it. That camera body will go obsolete in just a couple of years, if not in a few months, and you will be stuck with an obsolete camera body and poor lenses that you just had from the beginning. So I would argue that sure, you should spend some money on a decent camera body, but also allocate some of the money in your photography budget for some good glass or some good lenses that you can put in front of it, because that is a worthwhile investment, that you can change camera bodies and still maintain this excellent glass that you have in front of it. Okay, so after that quick rant, let's just go into some of the properties of lenses. So remember that we did talk about one thing, and that was the F number. And the F number relates the aperture, which is basically the hole that allows light into the lens and into the sensor. And we talked about this equation for F number, which equates the focal length divided by the diameter. And we glossed over focal length before, but essentially focal length means the magnification of a particular image. So if you have a lens with very, very large focal lengths, perhaps 200 millimeters, for example, that will be much more zoomed in or much more magnified than a lens that is much shorter, so maybe 50 millimeters, for example. And if I were to go back just a couple of slides, remember when I showed this this icon from Apple's Aperture, you'll notice that it actually has a designation of a length on the side. It says 50 millimeters right there. And just about every lens that you have will actually show you the focal length on it. And so in this case, there's only one focal length, 50 millimeters, but typically you will have zoom lenses that can go through a variety of focal lengths. So you might have one that goes from 18 millimeters to 55 millimeters, for example. You might have one that goes from 28 to 105, for example. They even have some that are 70 to 200, and each of these can be compared to one another in terms of their magnification power. But it's important to realize that there's something called the zoom power that many people like to, or many manufacturers like to refer to. So for example, they like to say, we have a 30x zoom on this digital camera. And all that really means is that the longest focal length is just 30 times the shortest. But that doesn't necessarily tell you much about how wide or how much you can get into the photo and how zoomed in you can actually go. So for example, I need to make sure that this is not actually a permanent marker because I have made that mistake before. So for example, let's say that we had a lens that goes from, just for the sake of simplicity, that goes from 20 millimeters at the wide end to 100 millimeters. Now, just keep in mind that this is for a typical SLR camera, and typically for just for a film camera, for example, what's considered a normal lens is 50 millimeters. So let me just go on a brief tangent about this before I go on about the zoom magnification. Now, 50 millimeters on a typical SLR camera or a typical film camera basically means that when you are looking through the camera and the lens, it appears to be, or what you see through the lens is approximately the same magnification as your eyes actually are viewing the scene itself. So you can think of your eyes as being sort of 50 millimeter lenses if you want to think of it that way, though that is clearly not, that is definitely not the case. So anyway, when we talk about focal lengths that are shorter than 50 millimeters, that means that you are more zoomed out. So that's as if you were able to get more of the scene than you could. So when we're talking about lenses that are less than 50 millimeters, these are typically called wide-angle lenses. Wide-angle lenses, because you can get more of the scene into your photograph than you could with a longer lens. So keep in mind, when I'm using this term longer and shorter, I am referencing the focal length. And so shorter lenses then are wide angle, and longer lenses then, so greater than 50 millimeters, are called telephoto lenses. And these are more zoomed in, or more magnified, so to speak. So it's as if you were zoomed in a lot more on some particular object. Okay. So just keep in mind that for 35 millimeter cameras, so film cameras typically, especially SLRs, 50 millimeter is sort of the baseline. So let's get rid of this and go back now, take a step back and talk about these zoom lenses that I was referencing just a minute ago. So we have a couple of lenses. Let's say we have one that goes from 20 millimeters to 100 millimeters. So you can tell that this goes from a fairly wide angle at 20 millimeters all the way to a fairly zoomed in telephoto range of 100 millimeters. Now let's assume for a minute that I have a different lens altogether, 70 millimeters to 200 millimeters. Now let's take a look at some of this stuff. When we're talking about the magnification power, when one of these companies say it's a 3x or a 5x zoom, they're taking the longest focal length and just dividing it by the shortest. So in this top case, 20 millimeter to the 100 millimeter, it's just a 100 millimeter over 20 millimeter lens, which means that it's a 5x optical zoom, which means that basically you can magnify what you appear through the viewfinder five times before you reach the maximum amount of being zoomed in. So that sounds pretty good, and indeed this would be a fairly good zoom. But let's take a look at this other lens really quick. So we have this 70 millimeter to 200 millimeter. If we take 200 millimeters divided by 70 millimeters, perhaps. So this is a very common size, but just to make it easy, I will change the lens to be 70 to 210 millimeters rather than 70 to 200, just so that it divides cleanly. Okay, I have a 70 to 210 millimeter. I take 210 divided by 70, and now we see that this is only a 3x optical zoom. Now you might say that this does not zoom in as far as this original lens. However, that is not the case. You have to take a look as well at the total zoom range. So realize here that at the furthest telephoto, at the longest possible focal length of this lens, this is 210 millimeters, which is twice as powerful or twice as magnified as this 100 millimeters from before. So just because we are told that this longer lens, this lens overall, the second lens is overall longer than the first one, just because it only has a 3x optical zoom, it doesn't mean that it's worse than this 5x optical. So you have to take this whole thing into account. You really should, though, only compare the zoom ranges between sensor sizes that are exactly the same. So this is meaningful to us because I am talking about, let's say, a 35 millimeter frame. So just the typical film camera or a large SLR, 35 millimeter. If you were to compare compact cameras, you would actually notice that they typically have focal lengths that are very, very small, maybe usually in the 6 to maybe 20 at the most millimeter range. And those are a lot more difficult to compare. You must first make sure that the sensor size is the same between two cameras, and then you can compare the focal length between them. And we'll talk about why that is important, of course, at a later lecture. But just realize that when they say 5x optical zoom versus 3x optical zoom, they could be fudging the numbers a little bit just so that they can get a better sounding number than what it actually is. And we have to talk about the magnification that can result because of the different sensor sizes before we can have a truly thorough understanding of why this is the case. But anyway, realize that we can have some lenses, as is the case in this icon over here, where it only has one focal length that's possible, or we could have a zoom lens that has a range of focal lengths that it can go through. So both of these lenses over here are zoom lenses because they can change their focal length so that you can zoom in or you can zoom out. However, we have what's called a prime lens over here because it does not change its focal length. It remains fixed no matter what you do. Even if you focus it, it's still going to be at the same focal length. Now, you might say, why on earth would we pick a prime lens over a zoom lens? Well, typically, prime lenses are much simpler because they only have one focal length to have to deal with. And so they can have much larger apertures, so they can have much lower F numbers. Notice this number here, it says 1.4. That sounds suspiciously like an F number, and indeed it is. So this has a very, very low F number that can be used, whereas with many zoom lenses, you typically do not have F numbers that are that low. You typically have to have apertures that are much smaller, so you will have much larger F numbers. So prime lenses are very good for what they do. They can give you very excellent quality because they're simpler to design, they're simpler to make. They can be cheaper than their zoom lens brethren. They can have much larger apertures, which means that they would be excellent for low light capabilities, but they just do not have the practicality as zoom lenses. So with zoom lenses, you can have a range of focal lengths that you can go through. So you can zoom in, you can zoom out to adjust your needs. However, they are bigger, they're bulkier, they're more complex to design, so they're not as high quality. And they are also, therefore, more expensive. Okay, so moving on. So when I was talking about the F number here, this is actually quite a large oversimplification from a lens. Right here, I'm basically just showing one glass element that exists in this lens that focuses the light that comes into it into the film plane. Lenses are actually much more complex than this. This is a diagram of a lens, and each curved object in the middle here, including the colored ones and the transparent ones, are actually glass elements that are used in compound form. So overall, all of these things perform the same basic principle as this oversimplification here, to focus the incoming light through the lens and onto the film plane at the rear of the camera. Okay, so one more thing I want to mention about zoom lenses is that we were talking about optical zoom here, where the lenses themselves can actually change their focal length so that you can zoom in or you can zoom out. And remember that zooming in means that you are magnifying magnifying the image more so that it appears more zoomed in. Zooming out means that you're decreasing the focal length, so it's a shorter focal length, and you're getting more of the scene into the image. But back to this is called an optical zoom because the lens itself has the capability of performing this zoom. So there are glass elements here within the lens that actually move. So most likely this whole first set of elements here actually moves back and forth in order to zoom the lens. However, there are some strange lenses out there that exist where it actually appears that they shrink when the focal length gets longer. Don't get this confused. The focal length actually has not much to do with the physical size of the lens itself. Really depends on many, many factors. So do just realize that in general, and we do have some examples of this, that the longer focal lengths that you have will result in bigger, longer lenses, but you can have some that are slightly backwards. But anyway, this is called an optical zoom because you're actually changing the optics itself in order to zoom in or to zoom out. However, some cameras actually have a digital zoom that they can apply in addition to or instead of this optical zoom. This works basically just like resizing an image on your computer. So if you were to have a photo on your computer and you wanted it to be twice as big, you go into Photoshop and you make the size, you make the height and the width, let's say 200%. So what happens there is that you are increasing the size twice as much, but you don't have any additional information there. So you're basically just doing nothing to the image. So digital zoom, in my book, is a big no-no. It's really unnecessary. It's completely useless because you can usually do a much better digital zoom on your own computer, a much higher quality. And frankly, you really shouldn't do that. Using an optical zoom is preferable. And if you have the choice on your camera, you should certainly disable the digital zoom feature. It's just not useful. You will lose quality. It's just very, very poor. They usually try to combine this optical and digital zoom into one, sort of meta zoom, so to speak, where they combine both in order to say the full optical power of this camera is 200x or something like that, which is completely bogus and completely unnecessary. It's just all marketing speak, frankly. Okay, so let's take a step back and take a look at how images are impacted by different focal lengths. So you, on your camera, you typically probably have some very standard lenses, especially if you have a compact camera, where you have in 35 millimeter terms, so let's just say that we upgrade the size of your compact camera and bring it to about the same size as a 35 millimeter camera, so that we can make this comparison, remember, between 50 millimeters being a normal lens, less than that being wide angle, and more than that being telephoto. If we were to be able to change the size of yours so that we can compare it along those same lines, you probably have a lens that is about 35 millimeters on your compact camera all the way to, let's say, maybe 200 millimeters. So you have a fairly good degree of optical zoom here from a fairly wide angle at 35 degrees all the way to fairly telephoto, or not degrees, I'm sorry, 35 millimeters all the way to a fairly telephoto range of 200 millimeters. And this is actually called a 35 millimeter equivalent. And when we talk about different sensor sizes, we'll talk about what that means in more detail. But this is the same thing as that 35 millimeter equivalent. If you were to look up the technical specifications on your camera. So I'm just guessing here, this is a pretty typical range for a compact camera. But what does this mean? How does this actually look? And what happens if we were to have a camera that's not 35 millimeters, but maybe half that, maybe 17 millimeters? And instead of 200 millimeters, what if we had something that was much longer? Well, once we get much longer than 200, it's difficult to show you because these lenses get very, very expensive. But I do have some examples throughout some of this other range. So, for example, you may remember these photographs from a couple of lectures ago of my brother and sister. So the photo on the left of my brother was actually taken at 80 millimeters, which is just slightly longer than telephoto, but it looks sort of right in terms of the amount of zoom. It just does not look over magnified. It doesn't look under magnified. It sort of looks as though you were looking at the scene. And indeed, on my camera, 80 millimeters is actually fairly normal. So on the right, though, we have essentially the 35 millimeter equivalent of 16 millimeters. And that's really very zoomed out, which means that in order to get my sister in the picture, I had to be very, very close to her. So remember that if you're very zoomed out, you can get a lot more in the frame. So in order to get something small into a frame where you're very zoomed out, you have to get very close to it. And what happens at these very small focal lengths, at these very short focal lengths, when you get closer to an object, is you get this distortion called perspective distortion. So my sister does not look this wacky. I can guarantee that to you. So it looks as though her head is elongated and her body is sort of stretched and contorted. And that is because of this perspective change that occurs with this very, very short focal length. So we have to talk then a bit about perspective changes that can occur when we are talking about lenses. So the next slide, bear with me for just a bit, but we will hopefully get through this without too much of a problem. So when you zoom out on a photograph or from a photograph and you step very, very close to something, you're typically going to be exaggerating all of the features of a person or an object, and you are very much going to be separating something from its background when you are using a very, very short focal length and you get close to it. However, if you use a long focal length and you step away from it, so remember, in order to get the same thing when you're very zoomed in, you have to take a few steps back so that you can get the same amount in your very zoomed in photograph. When you do that, it actually compresses the image a little bit. And let me show you what I mean by that. So I have here four photographs. I did not take these, but I shamelessly stole them off of a wonderful tutorial website. But I think this very well shows the changes in perspective that I want to show. So we have here four photographs of, basically, I think they're salt and pepper shakers. We have in this order the first photograph, so one in the upper left-hand corner, two upper right-hand, three, and four. So just like you would read panels in a comic book, so should you look at the photographs here. So you'll notice that we have a variety of different looking photographs. So let's take a look at some of the details from number one. So in this case, they took a photo of these two salt and pepper shakers by placing the camera some distance away from them and using a 33 millimeter lens and taking a photo. So it's a fairly wide angle photograph of these salt and pepper shakers. Okay, so now let's assume for a minute that they took this red box in software. So they took this photo, number one, they took this red box here, let's say in Photoshop or something, and cropped the image. So they cropped the image and made it larger, and that is, the result of that is number two here. So just take a look at how it looks in terms of the distance between the two salt and pepper shakers. It's what we're looking at here is the perspective. And all we've done is zoomed in basically by cropping that image and making it bigger. Okay, so forget that for a second. And now let's say that we swap lenses. So we take off this 33 millimeter lens and we put on an 80 millimeter lens onto that same camera. We then take a picture. The result is number 3. Excuse me. So now compare number 3 to number 2. You'll notice that they are, for all intents and purposes, exactly the same. They're very, very similar. Perhaps there's some slight color variation, or maybe one of them is slightly more tilted than the other, but the perspective looks essentially exactly the same. And that shows you what happens when you zoom in or zoom out on something without changing your distance from it. So when you're zooming in, when you're using a longer focal length, a higher focal length to zoom into it, you are essentially staying that same distance away and cropping that out of the scene and making it bigger. You're just magnifying it. That's all this is doing. So we don't even have to use the word crop for this red box in number 1. If we just made this bigger so that it was the same size as this photograph here, we're magnifying that portion of the image, right? And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Using a longer focal length while keeping the same distance from it means that you're just magnifying that section of the image so that the perspective remains the same. So really all of these three things, 1, 2, and 3, are essentially the same thing, except obviously number 1, you're just using a shorter focal length so that you're getting more of the particular area of the image in. Okay, so number 4 looks a lot different. Let's point out some of the differences. First of all, notice that the tiles along the bottom look more elongated. It looks as though it's stretched slightly. Notice that the difference between the distance of the salt and pepper shaker is pronounced. The angles are harsher, so to speak. We can tell that it is the same object, but it looks different, especially when you compare number 4 to number 3. The perspective has changed. And the reason for that is that we changed our distance from these objects. So what we've done is we've moved the camera from our original position in this image number one, we moved it closer, maybe to where the bottom of this red box is, for example. If we keep the wide-angle lens on, we are still relatively zoomed out, but because we're stepping closer to it, we are now keeping this change in perspective, or we are keeping these two things in the frame only, but we are changing the perspective because we have gotten closer to it. And you can actually try this at home. You can use your camera at its most zoomed out position. So if you zoom it out all the way to the 35 millimeter equivalent or whatever it is, you can try moving closer to objects or moving away from them to see how it affects your image compared to just standing in one place and zooming in on that image. So it looks different if you're standing in some place and zooming in on something versus keeping your focal length at a very, very low level and getting much closer to it. You are changing your perspective of that image. And in fact, there is a video that I have that illustrates this using a video. So this is from a movie. Unfortunately, I don't remember what movie this is from, but I think it has Robert De Niro in it. And what this is using is, I believe it's called the Hancock zoom, where what happens is the cameraman right now is in a certain position from these two characters and has a zoom lens on his camera. But what is going to happen when I start the film, or when I start this video, is you'll notice that the background changes relative to the characters. And so let's watch what happens. I push play. So now, don't pay attention so much to the characters, but pay attention especially to, say, this car compared to those two, or to the background as a whole compared to these two characters. Notice that it looks like it's getting closer and closer. even though what had happened, excuse me, even though throughout this scene, these two characters remained roughly the same position in the frame, you'll notice that there is a change in the background. So as I go through it more quickly, it becomes more pronounced, where even though these two characters are exactly the same size in the frame from the beginning to the end, you can tell that the background looks much more distant from them at the beginning of the video than it does at the end. So what's happening? Well, at the beginning, the camera person is very, very close to these guys and is using the widest possible angle on their lens. Then when they say go, or what do they say? Action. Of course they say action. My excuse is that I'm a photographer, not a videographer. So when they say action and I hit play, the camera person starts moving backwards and zooming in at the same time. So because he's changing his distance, the perspective is changing as well. But he's able to keep his subject relatively the same size while compressing the perspective of the scene. So it looks like the background is getting closer when all that is happening is that this person is taking steps back and zooming in at the same time. So that the zoom level of these two characters remains roughly the same, but all that's changing is the perspective of the scene. So pay attention, again, as I slide through it, not only that the background sort of falls into the distance as I move backwards, so that with this wider angle lens, the background looks much more separated from them, but also look at the angle of the table. So I'll move this up here, and if you pay attention to the angle of the table, you notice that it seems to flatten a bit as well. So when you have a wide-angle lens, it really distorts, it really pronounces angles. So you can tell that this cameraman was slightly above the angle, or was slightly above this altitude of the table here. But as we move away from it and zoom in, all of these angles become a lot less pronounced. So the background or the scene as a whole has become compressed, and I have changed the perspective of the scene itself. Okay. Well, this would be a perfect time to ask if there are any questions, but you'll have to do that on the forum and on the staff email. So how about some crazy perspectives that we can have? So if I use my wide-angle lens at its widest, most setting, I can get some of this really crazy distortion, some of this wide angle distortion that exists. So in this left picture here, for example, this is just a photo of a very old computer of mine where I'm using the widest possible angle on my wide angle lens, which is 16 millimeters, 35 millimeter equivalent. And I've gotten very, very close to the edge of the laptop. And because of the wide angle distortion, you can see that this angle, which should be a 90 degree angle, now becomes much more pronounced in this photograph. So this is a result of wide angle distortion by using my very wide angle lens. Similarly, if you take a look at this right image here, you can tell that there is some wide angle distortion because people are different sizes. So obviously different people have different sizes, but in this case, some folks are abnormally larger than others, not because of any sort of physical indication, but just because of the optical distortion that exists because of this wide angle lens. Using wide angle lenses can be very, very effective and certainly a neat way of getting some unique perspectives into a photograph. And I certainly recommend using wide-angle lenses if you have them available to you. Okay. So some of this distortion can actually be corrected. So if you want to use a very wide-angle lens and not get some crazy distortions in it, you can actually correct it. However, it's not cheap or easy. So one way to do it is with software. You could use Photoshop, for example. I do believe they have some perspective correction tools that you can use to try to make sure that these angles retain their proper shape and that you are still able to maintain some things in the frame without altering their appearance too much. However, we try to avoid, when we're taking the photograph, we try to avoid using software at first. We want to try to get the photograph right the first time. So this seems like a good transition to talk about certain class of lenses that exist called tilt shift lenses. And so they typically look like these. So this is the Canon offering of tilt shift lenses, which I think is actually only recently been made obsolete with the inclusion of perhaps a fourth one, or at least they have replaced one of these with a more modern lens. But you can see that they look slightly different. They look like they are bent slightly, or that they have shifted slightly in some direction, and that is indeed what this means. And we'll go into this into a little bit more detail about how this works in just a little bit, but using tilt shift lenses, you can actually shift or alter the perspective on a particular image and use it to correct some problems that exist, and you can even use them to fix some problems that you didn't even know existed in the first place, I'm sure. But before we get into that, it seems useful to take a step back and reveal some of the data that lenses tell you right off of the bat. So if you remember, I referenced that aperture icon earlier on that showed us it was a 50 millimeter prime lens. Well, just about every lens worth its salt will show you the data, the important data regarding its focal length and also its maximum aperture. So remember that a maximum aperture means it's the lowest f-number, it's the biggest size that the aperture will be, and this is typically what we are not interested in. Sure, we are interested in the minimum aperture as well, but not necessarily as much as a lens's maximum aperture. So I have a few examples here. Let's take a look at this top left one. It's an SMC Pentax DA lens. This is a Pentax lens. Let's see. And it says 1:4 and then in parentheses 22. So in this case, what this is telling us on lenses, you'll typically see the F number being represented rather than it being F number colon or F slash, as you might see on certain online publications. On lenses, we typically see the aperture being denoted in this colon sort of format. So 1:, and then the F number. So we can tell that the maximum F number of this lens is F4. The minimum, it's in parentheses, so we know it's the minimum, is F22, which is actually pretty small. If you take a look at it, I believe this lens is completely stopped down right now, which means that the aperture is as small as it can be, and you can see that the aperture becomes quite small. Most lenses won't actually tell you the minimum aperture, but we don't, like I said, we don't really care about that. Now, the next piece of interesting information is the focal length. So in this case, this lens is a zoom lens from 16 millimeters to 45 millimeters. So this is a wide angle lens because it doesn't, it's a wide angle zoom lens because it doesn't cross over this sort of 50 millimeter normal lens barrier that exists. And we can imagine that if we were to use it on a typical 35 millimeter film camera, that it would be a wide angle lens. We would probably get some of this distortion that I mentioned earlier. Okay, so on the right, then, upper right, there is a Canon lens. It says Canon zoom lens EFS, and so it really depends on what manufacturer you are purchasing a lens from, but usually these other symbols will denote the type of mount that the lens will be useful for. The mount just means what will tell you which cameras it can go on. So an EFS lens is actually for Canon's smaller sized SLR sensor cameras, so like the 20D, 30D, 40D, not the 5Ds or the much more expensive cameras that are larger sensors, but you'd have to look to make sure that your camera can support a particular lens mount. Anyway, the data that we are actually interested in is the following data. So this is an 18 to 55 millimeter lens, and we can see that it has an aperture of 3.5-5.6. So whereas this lens on the left had a constant maximum aperture of f4, which means that no matter what focal length you were on, all the way from 16 millimeters to 45 millimeters, it was always going to be f4 as the maximum aperture. You can't go to f2.8, but also you are guaranteed throughout this zoom range to have a maximum aperture of f4, whereas this one you have a constant maximum aperture. On the Canon lens, you do not. So you have a maximum aperture at the widest angle of 18 millimeters of 3.5, of f3.5, and then as you zoom in more to 55 millimeters, you get a maximum aperture of 5.6. So based on what we know about lenses, we typically want lower F numbers on lenses because then they have larger apertures, we can get better background blur, they will be brighter. Remember that because when you have a lower F number, you will actually get more light into the camera, so it will be a brighter lens. The camera will be able to take photographs in situations of lower light. So typically we would pick, if we got to pick between these two, we would try to pick the lens on the left, perhaps, because it has a much better F number rating and it's not going to vary so much on us. And so typically with consumer grade lenses or with lenses that are perhaps made to be a little bit more accessible in terms of cost, you will typically find that the F number will vary. And almost always, I've not yet seen a lens where the smaller F number is associated with the wider angle of the focal length. So in other words, when we're told that it's 18 to 55 millimeters is the focal length range of this lens and that the F number range is 3.5 to 5.6, we're pretty much guaranteed that at 18 millimeters, we're going to have a maximum aperture of 3.5. But at the longer focal length of 55 millimeters, we're going to have a maximum aperture of only 5.6. So this may not make a lot of sense to you, but remember, what is F number? F number is just that equation of the focal length divided by the diameter. So as you increase the focal length, if you don't change the diameter, you're going to get a higher F number. It's going to be darker, and that is most likely the case of what is happening here. The diameter doesn't actually change very much. When you have more expensive lenses, they typically can have more glass so that you can have a larger aperture and therefore a lower F number throughout the zoom range. So at the bottom, there is a third lens where this data is imprinted not on the top or the front or the face of the lens when you're looking at it, but on the sides. This is another Canon zoom lens. It's a 70 to 200 millimeter lens. If you remember, I mentioned that was a somewhat common telephoto lens. And this is a 1:4. So this is an f4 lens, and it remains a constant f4 throughout its zoom range. Typically, like I said, you want to maintain a constant zoom range if you can. It's usually indicates a higher quality lens. So there's one more piece of data that I want to point out. That is, if we go back up here to the Pentax lens, we see that there is a strange symbol followed by 67 millimeters. And this symbol may look somewhat familiar to you, but hopefully you won't get it confused with this similar symbol that we've referenced before. Remember before we referenced this symbol, this circle with a line through it vertically. And we mentioned this in the first lecture, and this was the location of the film plane on the camera, which means is that when you see this line right here, and you take a plane, you just cut right through the camera at that line, that's where the sensor location is. However, this symbol is a circle with a line through it diagonally, so you could call this the null sign or variety of other things that this symbol also represents, but this is not the same thing. This means filter size. Now, a filter size is basically just an object that can literally be screwed onto the top of these lenses, and you can adjust the light more based on what the filter is. And we have some examples of what filters are what different filters can do. You might recognize some as being neutral density filters. Some can actually adjust the color of the incoming light. Some will actually adjust the density so it will become darker as it comes in. Others will polarize the light, if you remember our discussion briefly about light polarization before. There's a variety of filters, and generally when you buy a filter, you need to know the size, and it is printed right on the lens what the size of the filter should be. So this is a 67 millimeter filter size, this Pentax lens, whereas this Canon is a 58 millimeter filter size. Okay, let's just take a quick 5 minute break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about optics. Hello, welcome back. So before, I was fumbling about trying to remember the name of the movie that this perspective change came from, and I even messed up the name of the effect. So this effect where you zoom out as you move closer, or you zoom in as you move farther away, is popularly called the Hitchcock effect, not the Hancock effect, the Hitchcock effect, because he really popularized this in some of his movies. Usually, directors of photography and directors themselves will use this sort of effect much more quickly than in this scene, which incidentally is from Goodfellas, and they will use it very quickly to mean some sort of very drastic change or some state of surprise that a character will typically be in. So, after you've had it pointed out to you, I know that the first time I learned about it, I started seeing it everywhere. It's used everywhere. And it's really neat now, I think, to know how you can actually take a photograph of that type. Okay, so very quickly, I have here just a photograph showing a number of different lenses that are available, and you can see some of the differences in the sizes, and trust me, these look a lot smaller than they are. I wish I could show you exactly how large they are, but this farthest left one, excuse me, is I believe about 6 to 7 inches long by itself, and so we get into much longer lenses, and then this lens is repeated again here for comparison to this far right lens to show you how much bigger. These are very, very large lenses. If you remember when I showed that image of the photographers from the Olympics, they typically use very long lenses that have very large focal lengths so that they can be very much magnified into the action. This is very useful for sports photographers. So from left to right, we have a 24 to 70 millimeter f2.8 lens. These are all Canons, incidentally, not just used as a reference, not as an example of great lenses, so to speak. Then we have a 70 to 200 f4. Now notice that this one directly to the right is also a 70 to 200. However, its maximum aperture is an f2.8. So it is one stop larger, but it is much bigger because there has to be a lot of extra glass to be able to support all of that extra light that can come in. So it's much bigger, it's much heftier, just with that one extra stop of light, but it can actually be very, very useful. So then again, we have this 70 to 200 f2.8, and then this middle lens on the right here is a 500 millimeter f4, 500 millimeter. It's very, very large. It's a prime lens, very expensive, many thousands of dollars, I'm sure, but it's very, very nice lens. This object to the far right is actually the lens cover for that 500 millimeter lens. The lens cover can swallow that 70 to 200 hole, and this 70 to 200 is no lightweight. It's probably a good, 4-5 pounds of glass and plastic just by itself. It's a very large lens. So, typically, you see many Canon lenses being white, and a lot of pro photographers like to have this sort of white, very large lens attached to their camera. But don't be confused, Nikon does also have some lighter colored lenses, and the reason that they are white is up for debate, but some people would argue that they are so large and so heavy that when you're using them outside, as you most likely are going to be using a very long lens such as this outdoors, it is helpful to keep the heat from the sun outside of the lens so that you don't destroy the autofocus mechanism. Okay, so For this shot, was actually taken with that 70-200 f/2.8 lens. And remember that I mentioned that typically for sports, you want to use every advantage that you can in order to get the fastest shutter speed possible. So this was taken at that lens's widest aperture, all the way opened up at f/2.8. So at an f/2.8, that's actually a very fast lens. So typically you'll hear people talk about fast lenses or slow lenses. If a lens has the capability to have very low F number, especially for such a large lens, then that will be a fast lens because you can increase the shutter speed. You can have a faster shutter speed while maintaining some really nice background blur and also, you can use very high shutter speed while not having a very high ISO and also getting some very nice background blur. So what causes background blur? So this I'm actually using as a way of representing a digital camera sensor. And this is just one type of sensor called a charged couple device or CCD sensor. Some of your cameras might have this type of sensor. Others won't. There's a variety of different types, but the types don't really matter right now. We don't care about that so much right now. But remember that a sensor is made up of tiny pixels or dots, and you have thousands of them in rows and thousands of columns that make up the pixels, that make up the megapixels of your particular sensor. And so because of this, every pixel actually has a finite size. So we have a sensor that is so many millimeters long, let's say 3 millimeters long by 2 millimeters high, and you might have several thousand pixels across this sensor, but that doesn't mean that the smallest ones have absolutely no size. They do actually have a finite size to them, and this is very useful to us when we are going to be talking about background blur. And so in order to talk about background blur, we actually have to introduce a somewhat unfortunately named term called the circle of confusion. And the circle of confusion is, it will be that if you let it be, but it really doesn't have to be. And basically, the circle of confusion is just the largest diameter at which light can be focused for something to be sharp. And so there's a variety of mathematical terms that can go into the circle of confusion, especially when we're talking about film cameras. But we can try to simplify this a lot and say that the size of the pixel on the sensor is actually the circle of confusion. And the reason for this, so let's say that we have a little tiny point of light somewhere, and we take our lens, this is our lens here, and the light is emitting light rays everywhere coming out of it, and so we capture light rays from our lens, and it focuses that like this onto our sensor right here. So this is how our camera and our lens basically functions. It takes emitted light and it focuses it down so that it becomes a point again on our sensor. But realize that we've been talking about this for a while, but this point doesn't have to be super duper tiny small. Because this pixel actually has a finite width and height, we actually have a range here where this focused light will fall exactly within that one pixel and will appear to be sharp. So here, this is what this diagram on the slide is for. When we have a circle of confusion that's a specific size, every time the light is focused more sharply than that circle of confusion, it is going to be considered in focus. And so if we go back to this example and say that roughly our circle of confusion is the size of a pixel, which may or may not be, it really depends. So if we say that it is the size of, the circle of confusion is the size of this pixel, then you can imagine that as long as the light that is focused from the lens is at least as focused as the size of that pixel, then it is going to be sharp. And so that's why we get this depth of focus. We get this range of in-focus light that exists because it is more in focus than the limit that is given to us by the circle of confusion. And so you can imagine that we can increase the depth of focus if these light rays are slightly more elongated. We can decrease it if they are sharper. If they are sharper like this, then the circle of confusion must be smaller. And that is exactly what happens if we talk about this in terms of aperture. So in this diagram, we have the same lens, but we have the top one where we have the maximum aperture, and then we have the bottom diagram where we have stopped it down, maybe a couple of stops, for example, or maybe even one stop. And so we have light that comes in, and it doesn't really matter that it's parallel. It just comes in through here and is focused by the lens. And remember that all lenses are way more complicated than just this element, but we're breaking it down just so that it looks easier. It's easier to comprehend. It breaks down this way, and then it becomes focused on a particular point. However, we have a specific width in which we can tolerate it appearing to be in focus. So this is the width here, and when we have such a wide aperture, the light that comes in is a lot sharper than it is when we have stopped down the lens. And that is because we have stopped these light rays that have such a sharp angle. So because of that, because these rays are not as sharp of an angle, it actually elongates the depth of focus, or it elongates the section where the light converges up enough so that it appears to be sharp to our cameras and to our eyes. So this is what happens when we increase the F number. We are decreasing the aperture, we are decreasing these harsh angled rays that occur, and we are increasing the depth of focus that occurs in your camera. And so we actually get a result because of this. And so besides just the depth of focus, the more you stop down the aperture, essentially the straighter, you can think of the rays of light coming in will be straighter and not have so much of an angle against a sensor. And this is why when we are looking for sensor dust on our digital SLR cameras, we want to increase the F number as much as possible. Because if we are using a very large aperture, so let's say this is my lens here, we have light coming in from a very large aperture. We have light coming in basically from many, many angles, and it will get around the dust that happens to be just right there on the point before the sensor. So this light will actually bounce around enough. Bouncing is probably the wrong word, but because the dust doesn't rest exactly on the sensor itself, but instead on the filter above it, the light can actually get behind the dust. And sometimes when you're using wide open lenses, you won't notice dust as much as you would if you stopped down. So if I use the same lens, stopped it down so that the aperture was very, very small, now light that comes in very sharply will not be allowed through. So it gets blocked by the aperture. So this is light that comes from the outside, gets blocked by the aperture, but light that comes in through the center that's very, very parallel will be now not blocked by the aperture, but the dust will actually stop it. So you would actually then see the dust on the sensor. And so typically what you want to do in order to see dust on the sensor is you want to increase the F number as much as possible. And the other reason is that you're really increasing the depth of focus, and it helps bring more into view. And it's all sort of the same reason as this circle of confusion. Okay, the problem with increasing the F number is that we actually get some problems from light. So remember that light acts as both a particle and as a wave. And if we have, if you remember from high school physics, when we had some experiments to do based on light diffraction, you can actually create light waves if you have a very, very small opening. So this is, so let's say that I have a, like a cardboard box right here, not a cardboard box, just a cardboard sheet, and I have a very small slit in the middle where light can go through. If it's sufficiently small, light will actually scatter around it, and you'll typically see this very, very strange pattern. So if we look at this same slit from a top-down view, waves that come in will actually turn into this weird wave pattern where it sort of disappears somewhere and not others. It's I don't want to go into too much detail, but if you're interested, look up light diffraction. But we actually get light diffraction artifacts if we increase the F number too much. So there's a point on all cameras where you'll increase the F number too much and you will stop getting this increased sharpness because of you're getting a much larger depth of focus, and you will start getting an increase in softness because of diffraction. So many compact cameras usually will not go above about F8. You'll not have a higher F number than that because the aperture itself will be too small and you will start getting light diffraction as a result. So that's just a small aside about light diffraction. But anyway, let's take a step back and talk again about depth of field. So in this case, this is the depth of focus because it's behind the lens. The same sort of thing exists on this other side of the lens where it's much larger. It's in the real world, and this is the depth of field. So it's the depth, it's the variety of things away from the camera that will be in focus. And you've seen examples of depth of field everywhere. And this is a different photo where we have just an integrated an IC chip in the center of the image, and everything before it and everything behind it is out of focus. So only the depth of field surrounding the chip here is actually in focus. And this is using a macro lens. Remember that if you really want to get the most background blur, you need to use either a very long lens or use the longest focal length that you possibly can, or use a macro lens where it really exaggerates a lot of the background blur. So we get a lot of things that are out of focus. And so there is actually a term for this area that is out of focus, or more specifically what it looks like when something is out of focus. And so notice that we have here little points of light, or what should be points of light, that have turned into these soft sort of geometric shapes in the background, and it is called bokeh. So different lenses will have different quality of background blur, and so it can range from somewhat nice to somewhat poor depending on how the lens is created, and the bokeh defines this, how this background blur appears. So you'll notice here that on this left image, which is actually just a crop from that same image on the previous slide, we actually have somewhat nice bokeh. However, what we see is so these points of light, they're just little tiny points that are emitting light or reflecting light, and normally if they're out of focus, it just becomes, we would expect it to be this sort of soft circle. And we sort of see that here, but if you look more closely, it is not actually that at all. These are actually, let's see, heptagonal. So they aren't circular, they have seven sides. So one, let's see if I can draw a heptagon. Two, three, four, five. Oh man, I messed up. Okay, this is going to be tough. So one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. So this is a poor representation, but it has the same number of sides. So rather than circular, it actually appears to be heptagonal. And take a look at these images on the right. So one of my friends when I was in college actually had a very large telescope. It was a wonderful telescope, and I connected my camera to it because I was curious and pointed it at the Prudential from, I believe I was a mile and a quarter away. So I was probably about 7,000 feet away from the Prudential at the time. And I tried to take photos of the top of it, and it was very late at night, so there's no one in it or anything like that, and I just thought it would be a fun thing to try. And what happened was that, so this very top right image is actually the full image from it. It's not a crop from it, but if you were to look at the original image, you can actually read the exit on the exit signs, and it was really kind of cool, quite amazing. But because it was a telescope, it had terrible bokeh. So you can see this out of focus image where I didn't, I was still trying to focus the telescope at the time. We get this really strange donut shape bokeh, and so rather than it being a perfect circle, now I have this donut shape that happens as a result. And the reason that we have all of this bokeh that's not perfectly circular deals with basically just the aperture of the lens. So in this case, we have those aperture blades. Remember that there's a set of metal blades or plastic blades that stop down and close down in order to actually create a smaller area, to make a smaller aperture to allow light through. So in the case of this left image with these heptagons that we see, it's actually seven blades that close down. I don't even know if that's right. That's right. That close down, and as they get smaller, then we are increasing the F number. We are decreasing the size of the aperture, and we get this. But because this is what's blocking the light for the most out of focus points, this is what we see as a result. So typically the best bokeh that we see will be from lenses that have very, very circular. So they may also only have seven blades, but rather than them being straight as they are here, they might be slightly curved. So we might have one, two, three, oh, this is tough to do, three, four, five, six, seven. And so this already looks a lot more circular. So this is one reason that you might get better bokeh out of some lenses than you would out of others. Now the reason for this telescope being donut shaped was because it was a reflector type, where if we take a look at this, the telescope from this side, there is a convex mirror here, and there is another mirror here that basically acts as the viewfinder. So the light comes in this way, but there's this object in the middle. It's actually a mirror that reflects the light back up to the viewfinder. The light bounces off this part, but there's sort of a hole that exists in the middle. And you typically don't see it because when you're looking at objects very, very far away, pretty much everything is in focus. But when it's out of focus, you can actually see the result of this mirror type. So these types of lenses, these reflector types where there's something obstructing in the middle, are very unpopular with photographers for this reason, because the bokeh looks so absolutely horrible. And let's see, I have a URL here that's actually pretty interesting. Let me ring it up. And it's called What the Heck is Bokeh? And I will link to this later, but basically he explains some of the same things that I have, and he has shown some examples of bokeh based on some very high quality lenses. And this is a really good way to really start looking at bokeh, and I bet now you were never going to watch a movie or a TV show the same way again, because you will look at the bokeh and say, oh man, that's only a five blade aperture and it looks terrible. And you will be able to tell when they're swapping scenes. Sometimes they use better quality lenses than in other scenes, and the bokeh will look circular in some scenes and pentagonal or hexagonal in others. And it's really, really interesting to see the difference. And they go into a lot more detail than even I do. Some people really are strict about the way it looks. So not only must it be circular, but it must be completely uniform. It can't have any variation at all in color or in intensity and a variety of other things that go into some of the very strict rules that people have about bokeh. I just like to have very circular, as long as it's nothing too obnoxious, like this bokeh here where it's sort of halo-like. As long as it's not as obnoxious as that, then I tend to be pretty happy. But it certainly is an interesting look into different lenses that exist. Okay, so I've mentioned before, that when you increase the F number, you increase the depth of field, and therefore more things are in focus. However, there is an intersection. There's this sort of very happy middle place where you can maximize the amount of things that are in focus. And this is using the hyperfocal distance. And so basically all it means is that you're getting as much as you possibly can in focus. In this photo, for example, this was taken down in the pier near No Name Restaurant, I believe, and I think it's called Fish Pier. And this was taken using the hyperfocal distance. And if you look at the image, especially on the PDF slides, you can see that everything from the street that's absolutely closest to the camera all the way to the flag at the farthest end of the building is in focus. And this was done by using or by taking the photo with the hyperfocal distance. And basically, all the hyperfocal distance is that it's saying that everything from one half the focal distance, or one half the focus distance, not the focal distance, the focus distance, all the way to infinity will be in focus. So let's say you focus in on an object that's 3 feet away and you happen to be at the hyperfocal distance for your lens. That means that everything from 1.5 feet all the way to infinity will be in focus in your photo. Now, how are you able to do this? So there is actually a very nice, albeit somewhat scary, equation for calculating the hyperfocal distance on your lens. So the hyperfocal distance is equal to the focal length squared divided by the F number times the minimum circle of confusion diameter. So you can go online and you can look up the specifications for your camera, and a good website will tell you, it may even be in the manual for your camera, it will tell you what the minimum circle of confusion diameter is for your camera. So then you can just figure out for a particular focal length using a particular F number what the hyperfocal distance should be. So then from there you would know that if you focused in on something that is that distance away from you using that F number at that focal length, that everything from one half the focus distance all the way to infinity will be in focus. However, you don't have to calculate it. There is much easier ways to do it, and one way is using a website called dofmaster.com. And again, this will be linked online, and I believe there might be a reference to it in the assignment as well. They have a variety of tables, calculators that you can download for your computer, and I think even for your iPhone, where you can actually get help to do this. So let's try this online depth of field calculator. Typically, all you have to do is just give it your camera type. So in this case, my camera is already selected just because it likes me. I honestly have not set it before, so it's just luck of the draw. Now it's asking me to set the focal length. So I have to look at the data on my lens to try to figure out what the focal length is. If you're using a zoom lens, and if you're somewhere zoomed in the middle, you're going to either have to guess or just go to one of the extremes. And most likely, the better extreme to go to is as wide as you possibly can. So if you take a look at the data on your lens and you see something like 5.8 millimeters to 34.8 millimeters, remember, this is completely possible, especially on a compact camera. You might want to try zooming out all the way to 5.8 millimeters and then just inputting that as your focal length. Then select an F number, so maybe we'll do, so I'll select a focal length of 50 millimeters because that's a normal lens on my camera. I'll select an f-stop of f8 because that sounds pretty reasonable. Then you can calculate, you click calculate, and it will tell you on the right side here the hyperfocal distance. So it's saying that the hyperfocal distance is 54.1 feet away. So that sounds pretty far, but what that's saying is that if I'm able to focus in on something, if I'm able to focus on something 54 feet away, then everything 27 feet all the way to infinity will indeed be in focus. So this calculator is pretty nice, but I think what's better, what I prefer are the tables. So I try to go to the online depth of field table, and all you do is you give it a focal length, you give it the camera that you have and the units that you want. So in this case, I want feet or inches. And now this looks really crazy, but it's really not that bad. So remember that all you have to do to find the hyperfocal distance is to remember this definition, that the hyperfocal distance means that everything from half that focus distance to infinity is in focus. So if you can find that, you have found the hyperfocal distance. So if I go all the way, so this is in columns based on the F number, remember that a greater F number will have a greater depth of field, which will make the hyperfocal distance closer to me and easier to use. So 50 millimeter lens, that's going to make this somewhat difficult. So I'm going to try one of my wider lenses, maybe 20 millimeters that I actually have. Okay, so now let's say that I use F8, which happens to be in this column here. Let me see if I can make the text bigger so it's easier to read. So this is using a Canon 20D, focal length of 20 millimeters, because I've given it the data on my lens and my camera. Using F8, I go down the list and I see that there is a specific location where everything from about 4.5 feet to infinity is in focus. So that must mean that the hyperfocal distance is 9 feet, and that's exactly right. So here it says distance 9, and the hyperfocal distance, that's the hyperfocal distance, because everything from half of that, from 4.5 feet all the way to infinity, is in focus. And when we ask you to take a photo at the hyperfocal distance, you can use any method that you want to calculate what the hyperfocal distance is. You can use this table, an online calculator, anything like that. Just tell us what you used to make it, and then focus in on something that's that distance away, and you will be able to take a photo at the hyperfocal distance. Now, to try to solidify this idea, some lenses, especially older manual lenses, gave you a depth of field calculator right on the lens. And so in this case, this is the top of a lens where it shows us distances marked in the green feet and the white meters, and we are given a variety of colors. And notice that these colors match up with the F numbers that you can select along the bottom. So in this case, this is an older lens that you would literally rotate this ring and select the F number. So I could select an F number 2.8 all the way to 4, 5.6, 8, 11, or 16. So let's say I chose F8 right here. I selected that, and now it tells me from this green line to this green line, what my hyperfocal what my depth of field is. So if I were to focus in on something at this middle line, if I were to focus in on something 15 feet away, then this green line, this green range, tells me that everything from about 11 feet at this right end to 30 feet is in focus. And so if you have a lens like this, it actually becomes very easy to figure out what the hyperfocal distance should be, because you set this left side, so I would set this left side to be at infinity, then this right side would probably be at about 20 feet or so, and then this focus index would tell you exactly the distance that you are focused on, and that is the hyperfocal distance. So really all it is everything from one half of the focus distance to infinity is in focus. It's just a special set of circumstances where that condition is true. Okay, so moving on a little bit, we actually have some other neat technologies that exist in optics today, such as image stabilization. Typically it's called IS. Different manufacturers have different names for it, but usually this is the end result. If you have image stabilization and it's off and you're trying to hand hold a camera and take a photograph at a specific shutter speed, if the shutter is open for too long, you're going to get some shake and you will get this sort of blurry result, this blurry motion blur fold filled image that exists. However, if you turn on image stabilization, it will stabilize the light that's coming in, and it will appear to be a bit sharper. So I believe Nikon calls it vibration reduction VR, Canon calls it image stabilization. Modern cameras will typically, or not modern cameras, but modern image stabilization techniques will typically give you about 3 to 4 stops of stabilization. And what does that mean? Well, remember that a while ago I said a general rule for being able to handhold a photograph would be at, let's say you're at 50 millimeters. You wanted to figure out about how fast you could, what the fastest shutter, or what the slowest shutter speed could be. You would just take 1 over the focal length, so 1 over 50 millimeters. So 1/50th of a second is probably the fastest that, as a general rule, I could hold that, the camera still, and take a sharp photo. However, when I say that we now get 3 to 4 stops of additional stabilization, this means that I can go, let's go 1 stop, so 1/25th of a second. Let's do another stop, that's 1/13th of a second. Let's go another stop, that's about 1/8th of a second. I'm rounding a bit here. If we go 4 stops, that's 1/4th of a second. So now 4 stops away, this technology is telling me that I can go where I could previously only hand-hold this photograph at about 1/50th of a second. Now with this technology, I should be able to hold it at 1/8th or even 1/4 of a second, which is really a very drastic improvement in getting a photo nice and sharp. However, you have to realize that there are some problems with image stabilization. When you are keeping your, let's take these two extreme examples, 1/50th of a second and 1/4th of a second. If you are taking a photo at 1/50th of a second, it not only stops the motion of you shaking the camera very well, but it also stops the motion of everything else in the photo. So if someone is running in a photo, for example, so this is my drawing of them running, and you take a photo of them at 1/50th of a second, they will remain relatively still. However, if you notice that you're getting some motion blur because of it, and you turn on IS, and so you go all the way down to 1/4 of a second, realize that they are still moving in the image. So even though everything that is still in the photograph is now stabilized and is not moving and is now very sharp and clear like this, objects that are still moving within the frame still are moving and are still subject to these to this motion blur that can occur. So I'm opening the shutter for longer, so if this person is still running across, I will get worse motion blur as a result. And so it's just important to realize that image stabilization cannot actually stop time. It cannot freeze time. It cannot stop objects or people in a frame from continuing to blur their own motion. But what it does do is it helps you stop motion blur because of you holding and perhaps shaking the image slightly as a result. So there are two different types of image stabilization. There's one that is lens corrected, where some of the elements, one or more elements in the glass itself, actually moves to compensate. Or there is some that is sensor corrected, where the sensor itself actually moves to compensate. So there's a variety of advantages and disadvantages to each. For example, if you buy a camera that does not have sensor-based stabilization, then that means that it will come from the lens, so that every lens you buy, if you want image stabilization, will have to have this capability in order for every lens you use to have it. So this can typically be a much more expensive solution. Conversely, if you buy a camera with image stabilization built into the sensor, then that will generally be a cheaper way, because you will already have image stabilization. You don't have to worry about buying lenses specifically made for it. However, as with many other things, if a lens is designed with image stabilization built into it, it will typically perform better than a much more generic form of sensor stabilization. So lenses can themselves be made specifically based on their own properties, and they might have better performance than just a generic sensor-based system would have. Excuse me. So there are also some problems that can exist with image stabilization technologies, particularly old technologies. What will happen is if you set, let's say you have a tripod and you set your camera on it. So I'll set my camera right here. And let's say that this camera happens to have a lens that is image stabilized on it. And so if you take a photo with an older image stabilization system, sometimes it will try to compensate for motion even if it doesn't exist. And so you will get motion blur introduced by the image stabilization system, even though none existed there in the first place. Modern systems tend to be a little bit smarter in most cases and will try to detect when they are on a tripod and will turn themselves off. You'll have to read the documentation on your own image stabilized lenses to see which of which case it is. So there are also a variety of image stabilizing modes. So there are some that can do image stabilization in both directions. So maybe you're trying to take a photo and it will make sure to stabilize not only left and right, so maybe you're accidentally shaking it slightly left and right, but also accidentally shaking it up and down. So this is sort of the typical mode that we would expect with an image stabilized lens or image stabilized camera. But there is also a different mode where it will only stabilize vertically, for example. And so this is sort of a panning mode that image stabilized lenses or camera bodies can have, so that it will make sure that the image is stabilized vertically, but you can move the lens left or right to follow the action. So perhaps there is a car that's driving by very, very quickly, for example. You want to have a slightly longer shutter speed so that you can take a blurry photo of the scene, but the car itself is in focus. And the way that you would do that is you would follow the car with your camera while having a somewhat longer shutter speed. That's a panning motion. You're going left to right, and that's the sort of image stabilization where that would be useful because it makes sure that your up and down vibration is corrected. But this panning motion that you are intentionally doing to follow the car along through its path is not corrected, and you don't get any sort of weird artifacts. You can still get motion blur, as I said, if you were to use image stabilized lenses and keep the shutter open for a long time. So don't expect it to freeze time. It doesn't do that. It only helps you keep the camera stable. It doesn't actually stop the effects of someone moving across a very open shutter. There is actually another advantage, I think, to having image stabilization in the lens rather than in the sensor, and that is that if you have it in the lens, you'll actually see in the viewfinder the result of image stabilization. And if you've never tried it, it's actually really, really cool. I think I've had a couple of image stabilized lenses on my camera, and as soon as you turn it on, if you're very, very zoomed in, if it's a large lens and you're zoomed in very far, and it's a heavy lens and you're trying to hold it still, there's usually a little bit of motion, but as soon as you turn on this image stabilization, it sort of shakes a little bit, and then all of a sudden it's just very still and very clear. It's a very eerie sensation, but it's also really neat, and you can tell that it is going to work. Of course, it's just sort of it's a nice feature to have, but in general, I think that if there was some sort of combination between the two, that would be best. But for now, it seems that I would still pick lens image stabilization if possible, just because even though it's more expensive, it will typically work a little bit better. But if money is a concern, then try to find a camera where it is built in there. Okay, so let's take a step back again and go back to these tilt shift lenses that I had mentioned before. And so with tilt shift lenses, they are actually somewhat expensive, but you can actually get some really neat effects out of them. So not only can they correct perspective, but they can also change drastically depth of field. within a particular image. So whenever you see images like this, where it looks very, very miniature, this is, even though the picture is not from a miniature itself, it is usually the result of either tilt-shift lens or everybody's jumping on the software bandwagon now, where everybody's trying to do this with their images using Photoshop or some online tools. So this is one result of a tilt-shift lens. This is actually the result of a shift with it. But there is actually something else, it's rather a result of the tilt with it. And there's actually something else that can change when you do a shift instead. So architectural photography actually benefits quite a bit from tilt-shift lenses. And let's say that you are taking a photograph of a building and you are on the ground. So you only have a couple of choices to take a photograph of this building. So obviously this building is much, much bigger than you are, unless you happen to be Godzilla. And you are here and the building is here and you're trying to take a photograph of this building. You only have a couple of choices to take the photograph. You can point the camera up, and then what would be the result? Well, you would get these sort of converging lines. So if we look at the photo, this is the result of the photo, we get this sort of converging lines problem where all of a sudden we get this building where the top is much smaller than the bottom. This is a perspective issue. Well, the other thing that we can try is to take some steps back from the building itself and keep our camera level with the ground and take a photo that way. So then what happens there is that, sure, we're much farther away from the building, but all of the lines of the building remain proper. So the building still looks upright, but the problem there is that in order to do that, you're going to have to get, a bit of the ground in there as well, because you're going to be just pointed straight, horizontally. So these are the two results of architectural photography that are mirrored in this slide here. So we have a couple of perspective issues. You have either this image one up here where you get converging lines as a result of pointing your camera up, or you get you have to take a few steps back and level the camera and try to take a photograph of it this way. Obviously, neither are ideal because you lose the lines or you lose the angles that can happen. You lose the angles from the building with these converging lines problems, or you lose detail in the building because you can only devote about half the frame. If you take many, many steps back, you can only devote about half the frame to the building itself. And so this is where shifting comes in handy. And what happens is that you are literally shifting the focal plane of this image. So let's take this image two, for example. Let's say that we can take this middle part and shift it down. Can actually shift this part down. This means that we have a lot more of that photograph available to us. So we can get a lot closer to the building and we can then fill the frame with it. So how does this actually work? Well, I have here just another simple diagram of a shift. And basically this top diagram here is the result of just the normal photograph that you're taking with the lens. You notice this is the center line through the lens, and these are rays of light that are coming from an object. It comes right into the center of the particular image. However, when you shift it, you can actually shift these lenses off of the focal plane slightly. You actually move the focal plane just a little bit, and you can change the perspective. And the way that you do this is that you you still point the camera straight on, so you're not actually looking up towards the building, but you're still looking horizontally at it. But since you are moving this portion of the frame downwards, you now are getting, so let's move that down slightly. So now this bottom part is now the ground. You now have all of this area to work with in the frame, so you can get closer to the building and fill your frame with the building that exists there. And that's just because you have shifted down the lens itself. Okay, so there's the shift, and then there's also tilting for these lenses. So this next one's going to look a little crazy, but don't worry, we'll step through it. So let's say that we have, now I have to introduce an additional ray of light. So rather than there being one point, there's two different points of light. And so in this top diagram, what we have are two points of light that are coming in, and they converge exactly onto the focal plane like we expect. And so this, I'll redraw this diagram just for clarity's sake. We have two points here that are about the same, that are about the same distance away from you. So maybe these are two streetlights, for example. It doesn't really matter. They're emitting light, and those rays of light come in through the lens and then are focused onto specific points, onto two unique points on the film plane or on the sensor plane itself. Now, when we do a tilt rather than shift, we are actually tilting the lens slightly. So what happens is that effectively the sensor looks like it's been tilted slightly, but really what's happening is that the sensor itself is not tilting, but the lens is tilting. So another way to draw it could be that the sensor is like this, but now all of a sudden the lens, rather than being vertical like it was, is now tilted slightly. And so this is what happens. You can actually tilt the lens slightly. Now these two rays of light, or these two points of light that were converging onto the same point, now converge on different points on the sensor. So this can actually change. Even though something is the same distance away from you, something will be in focus. It will actually change the depth of field in the sort of 3D motion, so that now rather than this point, so whereas both of these points became in focus on the focal plane here, now only this bottom one is in focus and this top one is out of focus, because they both don't converge on the same point on the focal plane. And so what you can do there is you can alter the depth of field quite a bit and get these sort of small, miniature-looking images where you have increased or you have decreased the depth of field drastically, because you're changing the way the light enters and converges into focus on the sensor itself. And so there are actually some ways in software that you can accomplish these same things, but it seems worthwhile to mention at least this tilt and the shift that can happen as a result of tilt-shift lenses. And there are actually a few companies that make some relatively cheap tilt-shift lenses. One is called Lens Baby. Let's see if I can look it up here really quick. But basically all it is just a very simple lens where you can tilt it and you can shift it around, and you can get this same sort of tilt shift change to this light. So just like this shows, you're actually able to tilt around the lens and alter the depth of field accordingly. Okay, so I also mentioned before that we've introduced this idea of a filter. So remember that this filter symbol is this circle with the diagonal slash through it. Typical sizes are usually 58 millimeters, 77 millimeters, and what you do is you screw the filter on top and you use it. So there's a couple of useful filters that I need to mention. Neutral density is very, very useful. Neutral density is a filter that decreases the amount of light entering into the camera without any other modifications. It literally makes the scene darker. And what this is useful for is very, very bright days where you want to decrease the amount of light coming in, so you can use a very long shutter speed. And that's exactly what we try to do here with water. If you want water to look very smooth, very, very milky or silky, or just a variety of other adjectives that we could apply to it, what you want to do is increase the length of time that your shutter is open. And in order to do that, well, you could increase the F number by a great deal, and we have certainly done that here. You can decrease the ISO as much as possible. Sometimes that's not enough. You actually have to mess with this fourth value of exposure, the amount of available light, and that's what this neutral density filter will do. It's just literally like sunglasses for your camera. It just darkens the amount of light that comes in, but it does it neutrally. That's why it's called neutral density. It does it without impacting any of the colors. It doesn't make any colors darker than others. That's why neutral density is important. If it affected the color, it would just be a color filter, and that's not what we want, really. So using a neutral density filter, we can increase the shutter speed, for example, something like this, or getting some interesting motion blur when it's very, very bright outside. Usually there's something called a filter factor, which is basically the number. It just tells you, usually you'll get like a neutral density filter with a number followed by it, so ND4, for example. Filter factor tells you how many times darker the neutral density filter will make it. So in this case, it's making it 4 times darker, which is 2 stops. So this is 2 stops of additional shutter speed that you will get from this particular neutral density filter. So not only are there neutral density filters, but there's also graduated neutral density filters. So whereas we have neutral density filters, so these are circular, because remember they circle or they screw onto your lens, whereas these are like the sunglasses, neutral density filters are like these sort of hip new sunglasses that the kids have these days, where they're darker on one side and then they get a little bit lighter. So you can get this this effect where it's darker on certain parts of the photograph and lighter in others. This is useful for cases such as very difficult mountain scenes, for example, or sunsets where you have a very, very harsh sunlight that's coming from the sky, for example, and you want to make this area slightly darker compared to this, which may be the ground, for example, which is already kind of dark. You want to make it lighter. So this is where a graduated neutral density filter would come in handy. You can make the sky darker and the ground would remain just as light so that you could maintain exposure, proper exposure throughout this entire image without sacrificing details in certain aspects of it. There's also graduated color filters. So you typically see this a lot on shows like CSI Miami, where they try to really make, and I mentioned that because I was just watching it yesterday and I was amazed at how well they were able to get the color from sunsets to come out. And that's because they use a lot of these graduated color filters where it's if it's a circle like this, it's very deeply orange up here, and then it just gradually becomes clear down here, so that when they point this filter at a sunset, it makes the orange much, much more intense without really affecting the rest of that image. And a lot of people use this to increase the color in the in their photographs. But I would argue that a lot of this color stuff that you can do, you can actually do very, very easily via software. So there is also this idea of a polarizer. And so this, I just want to show you the effects of a polarizer here. This is with a, this is just no polarizer. This is just a test photo that I was taking with no polarizer. Now I will put the polarizer on. So this is on. Okay, so I'll switch back and forth. Off, on, off, on. So you'll notice that it actually increases the contrast a great deal. It really brings out the colors in the area. What you want to buy, if you're going to look for one of these, is a circular polarizer rather than a linear. A linear one will interfere with the autofocus mechanism or the metering mechanism. So buy a circular polarizer. Basically, just all it means is basically it's just repolarizing the light as it enters the camera. That will be useful for it. But you will be able to increase the amount of contrast. You really pop the colors in your image with circular polarizer. It's a really great buy, I think. It's relatively cheap usually for small filter sizes. You can make the sky look really, really blue. Another thing that polarizers will do, just like polarized glasses, is that it will restrict polarized light coming into it. So in this case, light from the sky is being bounced, reflected off the water, and polarized. I can selectively remove that light and see what's underneath the water, which is actually pretty cool. You can adjust the how see-through reflections are. So glass, water, all of these things will polarize light as light is reflected off of it, and you can you can adjust using a circular polarizer the look of that particular image. And so this is really, really cool. And certainly filters are a fun thing to play with. So there are other filters as well. haze, UV filters, some of these things, I kind of question their value. Some people really swear by them, especially using like a UV filter or a haze filter in order to protect the front of the lens of the camera. However, what you're doing is every time you put a filter in front of the lens, you're adding additional glass in front of your lens, and you are increasing the possibility of distortions to be introduced. You are decreasing the amount of light because there is no filter, doesn't matter what kind it is, that will allow 100% of the light through, so you will get slightly darker. Most of the time you'll lose a third or more stops worth of light, and so frankly I think I tend not to use these sorts of filters because I buy my lenses to use them and I want them to be at their absolute tip-top shape. And so that should do it for now. Thank you all for watching, and I look forward to seeing you next week when we talk about the histogram. Be sure to bring any of your questions to the E7 forum, or feel free to also send an email to staff@cse7.org. Thank you very much.